Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi there, Herman and Corin. So I'd like to chat today about a topic that is really, really important to Israel and our national preparedness on the home front. And that's the question of safe spaces. It might seem like a kind of obscure topic for those folks who are, like most people, not affected in any way by the threat of ballistic missile warfare, but it is a threat here in Israel. And as we saw last summer, it became a 12-day war. My wife, as I've mentioned, is an architect, so spends a good deal of time actually looking at blueprints and working with structural engineers and contractors to figure out ways to create these spaces that meet the requirements. It has to be signed off by the government, these safe spaces. And they're mandated in new builds. The thing that's slightly ironic in our case, but is the case for so many people in Israel, older buildings don't have safe spaces. So we don't have a protected room in our apartment. And there isn't even one in our building. So during the Iranian war, one of the main reasons that we went into an underground car park, which was a designated safe space. So for the many Israelis who don't have a protected room in their apartment, or a protected floor called a mamak in their building, the guidelines, the Homefront Command issues very specific guidelines for what to do in the case of an incoming missile attack, ranging from what rooms that you could use in a push to where you might go in the stairwell, because we have to remember that a lot of, for 36-year-olds, we can get to the nearest shelter, but even for us, my wife was pregnant at the time, it's challenging if you get that notification and your choices become either do you sleep in the public shelter, even if there's no beds or air conditioning, or do you take the chance that you'll be able to get to it? So that was very much the logic we were working according to. It was a very stressful period just before Ezra was born. Literally, he was born a few days after the war ended. So it was chaos. But that's the other reason why we chose to shelter in a car park was that when I was geeking out about the Iranian missiles, which is kind of what you do if you have internet and you have to spend a lot of hours in a car park at nighttime, I was just astounded by the size of these things and how fast they move. And my thought as a non-engineer was just that a protected room at home isn't going to really provide much protection against a hypersonic missile. Now, of course, very unlikely that you're going to be hit by a missile, but then again, what's the point of going to public shelter if you're just relying upon luck? So the underground car parks, each municipality in Israel operates a list of public shelters, which are designed for this kind of use case where a lot of the population doesn't have a shelter. And the place we were in, which was 7 stories on the ground, my thinking was, well, that's probably just about the only place I feel like there's some chance. We saw tragically during the war with Iran that that shelter often wasn't enough. There were some cases of people who either didn't make it to the safe room, survived because they were there. And there was some debate in Israel about the logic of the private shared space and if it's actually a practical defense. It should be noted as well that these safe spaces aren't just there for rockets from Iran. They've, in the area around the Gaza Strip, they're protection against Qassam rockets. And as we saw on October 7th, some residents even managed to survive by hiding in their protective rooms. And in that case, they're supposed to be able to withstand gunfire. So Herman and Korn, I know that this is a bit of a heavy loaded and grim question, but I think it's important to talk about this. The actual mechanics of building these safe rooms that are supposed to withstand all these different threats, because they're different in scale and they're different in kinetic energy. My feeling, but again, I just want to, you know, emphasize that this is coming from a purely layperson perspective, would be that we might be better off building more robust and comfortable and viable safe spaces, because those things like a lack of air conditioning, when you're baking in a car park 7 stories down in the middle of July, as we were, that becomes a real threat to the elderly and even folks who are pregnant. And it's easy to overlook those things when we're talking about preparedness. So Herman and Corn, how are these built? And even though none of us want to be in a place where we're relying upon these potentially to protect against ballistic missile impacts, what do you think from experience around the world are the safest places to be if one finds himself in that kind of a situation? How are they built? And what makes a car park safe for this use? Because in Israel, it's important to emphasize for anyone listening that only certain car parks are actually approved for use as designated safe spaces. And the advice from the Home Front Command is if it's not, don't go there, because it can be an actually more dangerous space. You have the potential for a structural collapse. So let's talk, Herman and Corn, about safe spaces in Israel. Trying to build a place that is supposed to withstand all these potential calamities, and the difference in engineering between these shared spaces and the private ones that many people now have in their home in which it's mandated to be built.
Hey everyone, welcome back to My Weird Prompts. I am Corn, and I am joined as always by my brother,
Herman Poppleberry, reporting for duty. It is good to be here, Corn. We have a heavy one today, but honestly, it is one of the most practical discussions we could possibly have given where we live.
Yeah, that's right. Our housemate Daniel sent us a voice note about something that has been a literal part of our daily lives here in Jerusalem lately. He was talking about the engineering and mechanics of safe spaces in Israel. You know, he was mentioning how his wife, who is an architect, spends so much of her time looking at these blueprints and working with structural engineers to make sure these rooms actually do what they are supposed to do.
It is a fascinating intersection of civil engineering and high-stakes survival. Daniel was reflecting on his own experience during the Iranian missile attacks of 2024, specifically the stress of deciding where to go when you live in an older building that does not have a built-in shelter. He ended up 7 stories underground in a car park, which is a choice many people have to make when the sirens go off.
It is a choice we have had to think about, too. But it raises so many technical questions. What actually makes a room safe? Is a car park always better than a stairwell? And how do these structures handle different types of threats, from a small rocket to a massive ballistic missile? I want to really dig into the physics of this today.
I'm ready for it. I have been looking into the standards set by the Home Front Command, and the engineering behind it is much more sophisticated than just thick walls. It is about energy dissipation, pressure waves, and even air filtration.
Let us start with the basics for anyone who is not familiar with the Israeli landscape. There are a few different types of shelters. You have the private ones inside apartments, the ones on each floor of a building, and the big public ones. Herman, can you break down the engineering of the private safe room? What we call the MAMAD.
Right, the Merkav Mugandarati, or MAMAD. Since the early 1990s, specifically after the first Gulf War, every new residential building in Israel is legally required to have one. The core engineering principle here is that the safe room is not just a room with thick walls. It is actually a vertical reinforced concrete column that runs through the entire height of the building.
Wait, so it is like a spine?
That's right. It is a structural spine. If you look at a building under construction, you will see these concrete boxes stacked on top of each other. They are tied together with heavy rebar. This means that even if the rest of the building collapses around it due to a strike, that central column of safe rooms is designed to remain standing. The walls are typically a minimum of 20 to 30 centimeters of reinforced concrete. In areas closer to the borders, like near the Gaza Strip or the northern border, those requirements go up to 40 centimeters or more because the threat of direct hits is higher.
I've always wondered about the concrete itself. Is it just standard construction concrete, or is there something special about the mix?
It is usually a higher grade, like C30 or C35. The key is the reinforcement ratio. There is a lot more steel rebar in a safe room wall than in a standard exterior wall. This is to prevent spalling. Spalling is when the energy of an explosion on the outside of the wall causes chunks of concrete to break off and fly into the room at high velocity on the inside. Even if the wall does not breach, those flying fragments can be lethal. So, the engineers use a specific dense mesh of rebar to keep the concrete together under extreme stress.
That makes sense. But the walls are only part of it. The weakest points are always the openings, the doors and windows. Daniel mentioned his wife works with contractors on this. Those doors are incredibly heavy. What are they rated for?
Those are blast-resistant steel doors. They have to be able to withstand a specific pressure wave, often measured in bars or kilopascals. A standard MA-MAD door is designed to handle at least 1.2 bars of overpressure. They also have a double locking mechanism and a rubber gasket for a gas-tight seal. This is a legacy of the 1991 Gulf War, where the primary fear was chemical weapons. Even today, these rooms are built to be sealed environments. There is a special ventilation and filtration system, often called an NBC filter, which stands for nuclear, biological, and chemical. It creates positive pressure inside the room so that outside air cannot leak in unless it goes through the filter.
Positive pressure. That is the same principle they use in hospital operating rooms to keep germs out, right?
That's the idea. You pump filtered air in faster than it can leak out, so the airflow is always pushing outwards through any tiny cracks. It is a brilliant bit of engineering for a residential space. But as Daniel pointed out, the challenge is for people in older buildings. Jerusalem is full of beautiful old stone buildings from the early 20th century, or even earlier. They do not have MAMADs. So, the Homefront Command tells people to use the stairwell. Why is that the next best thing?
I can actually take this one because I was reading a report from a structural engineering firm on this. The stairwell is usually the most reinforced part of an older building. It is a small, confined space with multiple thick walls between you and the outside. If you are in the middle of the building, you have the mass of the entire structure acting as a buffer. The recommendation is usually to go down at least 2 floors from the roof, but not to the ground floor if there is a risk of the building collapsing on top of you. You want that sweet spot in the middle where you are protected from shrapnel by the outer walls, but not at risk of being crushed if the top floors take a hit.
It is all about layers of protection. Each wall the missile or shrapnel has to pass through absorbs a massive amount of kinetic energy. But let us talk about what Daniel did. He went to an underground car park. He mentioned it was 7 stories deep. Now, that sounds incredibly safe, but he also noted that the Homefront Command says only certain car parks are approved. Why the distinction?
This is where it gets really technical. A car park that is 7 stories underground is essentially a bunker. You have meters and meters of earth and concrete above you. That is called overburden. If you are that deep, you are protected from almost any conventional direct hit, even from a large ballistic missile. The earth itself is an amazing shock absorber. However, the reason many car parks are not approved is because of the risk of structural collapse and secondary hazards.
Yeah, like fire or gas leaks.
That's it. Think about what is in the car park. Hundreds of vehicles filled with gasoline. If a strike causes a fire or a structural failure that ruptures gas lines or fuel tanks, that underground space becomes a death trap very quickly. Also, ventilation is a huge issue. If the power goes out and the massive fans stop working, you have thousands of people in a confined space with limited oxygen and potentially rising carbon dioxide levels. An approved underground shelter has to have redundant ventilation, emergency lighting, multiple clear exit paths that won't be blocked by rubble, and a structural design that can support the weight of the entire building above it, even if the main supports are damaged.
That's a really important point. I think people often assume deeper is always better, but if the entrance gets blocked by a collapsed building, you are stuck. The engineering of the exits is just as important as the thickness of the roof. They often have what they call emergency egress tunnels that lead to a completely different area, far away from the main building footprint.
Daniel mentioned something else that I think is worth diving into. He talked about the difference between a rocket and a ballistic missile. We see a lot of Qassam and Grad rockets, which are relatively small. But the Iranian attacks in April and October of 2024 involved much larger weapons, like the EMAD or even claims of hypersonic missiles. Does the engineering of a home safe room actually hold up against a ballistic missile?
That is the million-dollar question, and it is where we have to be honest about the physics. AMAMAD is designed to protect against shrapnel and the blast wave from a near miss or a direct hit from a light rocket. It is not designed to take a direct hit from a medium-range ballistic missile with a 500-kilogram warhead. Nothing short of a deep mountain bunker is going to survive a direct hit from something like that. However, the probability of a direct hit is statistically very low. Most damage comes from the blast wave, or from fragments of the interceptor and the missile fall-in after the Iron Dome, David Sling, or Aerosystems do their job. For those threats, the MAMAD is incredibly effective.
It is about mitigating the most likely risks. It is like a seatbelt. It might not save you if you drive off a cliff at 100 miles an hour, but it will save you in the vast majority of accidents.
That is a perfect analogy, and we actually saw this on October 7th, 2023. Daniel mentioned that some people survived in their safe rooms even when their houses were attacked by gunmen. This is a different kind of threat engineering. AMAMAD door is not just blast resistant, it is also bullet resistant. The standard requirement is that it can stop 7.62 millimeter rounds, which is what an AK-47 fires. But there was a major issue that day. These doors were designed to protect against missiles, so they were built to be opened from the outside by rescue workers in case the residents were trapped. They did not have internal locks because the engineers never envisioned a scenario where someone would be trying to force the door open from the hallway.
I remember that. People were using chair legs and vacuum cleaner pipes to keep the handles from turning. It was a horrific realization that the engineering had a blind spot for a ground invasion.
And since then, there has been a massive wave of retrofitting. By early 2025, the Homefront Command approved new internal locking mechanisms that can be added to existing doors without compromising their blast rating. It shows how the engineering of safe spaces is an evolving field. It adapts to the threats as they change.
Let us look at the shared spaces for a moment. Daniel mentioned the MAMAK, which is the floor-level shelter. How does that differ from the private MAMAD?
The MAMAK, or Merkav Mukan Komati, is usually found in office buildings or apartment buildings where individual rooms were not feasible. Structurally, it is very similar to the MAMAD in that it forms a continuous concrete core. But because it is designed for more people, the engineering around the air filtration and the door size has to scale up. You need more air volume per person. There are also stricter rules about what can be stored in there. You cannot have flammable materials or heavy furniture that could become a projectile in a blast.
It is interesting how much of this is about the behavior of people inside the space, not just the concrete.
That's very true. Engineering is only half the battle. If you do not have the right protocols, the best shelter in the world will not save you. That is why the Homefront Command is so specific about things like staying away from the door and sitting below the window line. Even in a safe room, the window is the most vulnerable point. Even though it has a heavy steel shield on the outside and reinforced glass on the inside, you still do not want to be right in front of it if a blast wave hits.
You know, Daniel mentioned the irony of the lack of air conditioning and comfort in these spaces. He talked about being 7 stories underground in July with a pregnant wife. That is a real engineering challenge too, right? Human habitability.
It is a huge challenge. Most public shelters were built with the idea that you would be in there for maybe 20 minutes. They are not designed for long-term stays. But as we have seen in recent years, sometimes you are in and out of those rooms for days at a time. The heat load from 100 people in a concrete box is enormous. Concrete has high thermal mass, which means it holds on to heat. Without active cooling, the temperature can spike to dangerous levels very quickly.
So why don't they just put air conditioning in all of them?
It is a matter of cost and maintenance. Air conditioning units require external compressors, which are vulnerable to shrapnel. If the compressor gets hit, the system fails. You would need protected, recessed areas for the HVAC units, which adds a lot to the construction cost. Also, AC units require a lot of power. If the grid goes down, you need massive generators. Some of the newer, high-end buildings are starting to integrate this. But for the thousands of older public shelters, it is a massive logistical hurdle.
It makes me think about how other countries handle this. I know Switzerland has a law that every citizen must have access to a nuclear shelter. Their engineering is almost entirely underground.
Switzerland is the gold standard for this. Since the 1960s, they have had enough shelter space for over 100% of their population. Most of their shelters are in the basements of apartment buildings and houses, but they also have massive mountain caverns that can hold thousands of people. Their engineering focuses heavily on NBC protection because their primary concern during the Cold War was a nuclear exchange in Europe. Singapore is another one. They have integrated shelters into their subway stations and even have civil defense shelters in every high-rise apartment. Ukraine has also provided a modern masterclass in using deep-level metro stations as ballistic shelters, which were originally engineered with dual use in mind during the Soviet era.
It seems like the common thread is that if you live in a high-threat environment, the architecture has to reflect that. It cannot be an afterthought.
That's the core idea. In Israel, the architecture and the engineering are inseparable from the national security strategy. The fact that the population is so well protected is one of the reasons the country can function during a conflict. It reduces the pressure on the government to act impulsively because the civilian casualty rate is kept relatively low compared to the number of missiles fired. It is a form of passive defense that is just as important as the active defense like the Iron Dome.
I want to go back to the car park question for a second, because I think it is really relevant for a lot of people living in cities like Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. If you are in a situation where the sirens go off and you have to choose between a basement car park and a middle floor stairwell, what is the engineering logic for picking one over the other?
It depends on the building. If it is a modern building with a reinforced concrete frame, the stairwell is generally excellent. If it is an old, unreinforced masonry building, like those old stone houses we see in parts of Jerusalem, the stairwell might actually be a risk if the building collapses. In that case, a deep underground car park is safer, provided it has been approved. The key phrase there is approved. If the home front command has vetted it, it means they have checked the structural integrity, the ventilation, and the exits. If it is just a random basement, you might be trading a missile risk for a suffocation or entrapment risk.
That is a sobering thought. It really highlights the importance of that official vetting.
It certainly does. And to Daniel's point about his wife being an architect, the role of the architect here is to hide this engineering in plain sight. A good MAMAD should feel like a normal bedroom when it is not being used as a shelter. You have to balance the psychological need for a comfortable home with the technical need for a blast-resistant bunker. That is why they use specific types of plaster that won't crumble and turn into dust during a blast, and why the heavy steel door is often designed to be hidden behind a regular wooden door.
I didn't know that about the plaster. That is another one of those second-order effects. It is not just about the wall staying up. It is about the air staying breathable.
That's right. If the plaster on the walls turns into a thick cloud of dust the moment a shockwave hits the building, you are going to have a hard time breathing even if the room is perfectly intact. So they use high bond strength, flexible plasters that are designed to stay attached to the concrete under vibration.
This is all making me realize how much we take for granted. We walk into these rooms, we close the heavy door, and we just trust that the engineering works. It is a massive silent effort by thousands of engineers and architects over decades.
It truly is. And it is something that is constantly being tested and refined. Every time a building is hit, engineers from the home front command go in and analyze exactly how the structure performed. They look at the crack patterns in the concrete, the way the door hinges held up, the performance of the glass. All that data goes back into the building codes. It is a living, breathing field of engineering.
So, looking forward to 2026 and beyond, where does this go? Are we going to see even more advanced materials? Carbon fiber reinforcement? Ultra-high performance concrete?
We are already seeing some of that in military applications, and it is starting to trickle down. There is research into geopolymer concretes that are much more resilient to heat and impact. There is also a move toward smarter shelters. Imagine a safe room that can automatically sense a blast, activate its own independent power and life support, and even broadcast its location and the status of the occupants to rescue services via a hardened mesh network.
That sounds like science fiction, but given the pace of technology, it is probably closer than we think.
I believe so. But at the end of the day, the most important engineering is the simplest. Thick walls, strong doors, and a clear plan.
Well said. I think we have covered a lot of ground here. From the spine of the building to the physics of spalling and the hidden dangers of car parks. It is a lot to process, but it makes me feel a bit more appreciative of the walls around us.
Me too. It is a grim topic, but there is a certain beauty in the engineering that protects life. It is the ultimate goal of civil engineering, really.
Definitely. Before we wrap up, I want to say thanks to Daniel for sending this in. It is a topic that hits close to home for all of us here in Jerusalem, and it is something that I think a lot of people around the world are curious about, but don't always get the technical details on.
Yeah, thanks, Daniel. It was a great excuse to dive into the research. And hey, for everyone listening, if you are finding these deep dives interesting, we would really love it if you could leave us a review on your podcast app or on Spotify. It genuinely helps the show reach more people who are curious about these weird and wonderful topics.
It really does. You can find all our past episodes, including our discussion on urban resilience in episode 412, at our website, myweirdprompts.com. We also have a contact form there if you want to send us your own prompts.
We love getting them. All right, I think that is it for today.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Stay safe out there. Goodbye.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.